Hi folks, I am Alan Watt and this is Cutting Through the Matrix.
Ewing through massive changes, and Aldous Huxley and Mike Wallace show, he did talk about what he was concerned about. Now, he'd already been through Tavistock Institute. He knew they're putting wires in people's brains over there in England, and under the because they could always use so-called insane people, you see, at that time, way back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. To do their testing, this quiet testing. A lot of the people would have no relatives left, these patients, and if they had relatives at all, they didn't want to even come and visit them or know about them. So they were perfect for doing these experiments. No one would ask any questions. And they were way past the simple lobotomy stages back then, and they were putting implants in folks' brains with wires attached to them, just like they'd done with rats and so on, and Pavlov, and had been up to, etc. And you'll find that they wanted to find out how they could motivate people to change behavior by introducing currents into sections of the brain. They were mapping the brain back then, too. And Huxley talks about it. You can see where he was fascinated by certain experiments they did, and at the same time is giving you these little warnings about technology itself and the rapidity of technological advancement. Now that also included, he didn't mention it, but he knew it also included behaviorism and the psychology of the human being, the psychodynamics as they call it. And there were set behaviors that are born within you. They're innate, basically. They call them imperatives and all the rest of it. But why you do certain things when you're young, etc. Or mainly while you're young. But he knew all of this stuff was going to be used by the scientists at the top. The scientists he knew had already been destined to be a tremendous power, a force over the global population, and they would be of incredible benefit to the rulers of the world, the masters of the world. He called them the dominant minority, and he was well aware of them, of course, naturally. In fact, through marriage and so on, his family had been bred into them a while back with the Darwins and the rest of them. But I mentioned a lot of this before, you know, years ago, but you understand that he knew that someone who understood this very, very well, these techniques, could make ordinary people, he said, normal people, behave and do things which perhaps, in their best interest, they shouldn't be doing. He's talking about behavior modification on a mass scale. It's easier to do behavior modification on a mass scale than to do it individually. Because there are instincts, you see, in humanity. There's a herd instinct. There's a gregarious part of humanity, you see. And there's also peer pressure, incredible peer pressure. Young people have it perhaps more because they want to fit in and be accepted by their peer group. And so, getting back to the 60s and 70s, when they brought out a new, they always give you a new vocabulary for a revolution. It's trendy, you see, and you've a kid, so you're the in group, you understand the cool words and all the rest of it. Everyone's hip, etc., etc. So they always give you, whenever you hear new words being introduced, they don't come from the people from the streets. It comes from those at the top that put them out there through media, through their music and so on, to get you to emulate it. And it works awfully well. And since your target group really are the young, you see, the future citizens and adults and all the rest of it, then you must make it sound very exciting, like you're going somewhere. You're all going somewhere with the same opinions, the same everything, you see. And you're going to change everything. So in the 60s, they were concerned about nuclear war and all that. So the left groups, of course, the high left groups were doing their big, long demonstrations across the world in the so-called free countries against atomic warfare and peace, love, and all the rest of it too, at the same time. Where are they today? Well, see, the masses only follow the leaders of these far left groups. And if the leaders aren't told by the big foundations to go marching, then they sit at home and watch TV, you see. So you make it exciting and promote behavior, again, for a mass group. And again, peer pressures comes into and all the rest of it. Until to be with the in-group, you got to change the behavior and behave in a certain way. You adopt the terminology that's put for you to adopt. You all say the same things about, say, bands or groups and so on, or LSD or the latest drug or whatever it happens to be. And how everything's magic, you say, everything's magic. And out of millions of them, you're lucky if there's one or two who understand you're all being conned from that same age group. It's so perfect in its transmission to the masses through technology that it's very hard to resist it. Every child wants to be accepted by its peer group. Aldous Huxley, I put up the link many, many times years ago and up to the present, where he talks about that on the Mike Wallace Show, I think it was, that techniques have been found that worked. He was talking about behaviorism and psychology, mass psychology, who understood the behavior of people, psychodynamics and so on. And he knew that it was being used on the public and it could influence them to do things that perhaps, as he said, perhaps it was not in their best interests to do. It could influence you to do things to change your behavior, not for your own benefit, but for those who controlled you. It's never been more prevalent than today. There are many, you could do shows and shows and shows just rattling off the names and the quotes of people who talked about this. And it's all come to pass. And here's a sad thing you always find, and I've always found it. You can always point fingers at groups and peoples. And you'll be right too with many of them who can band together in clubs and so on and manage the world, just like cabals and cartels do in commerce. And they can certainly control the destiny of nations, especially when international corporations run the world, supposedly today. But the CEOs are also selected from this big pyramidal system very carefully at a young age. In fact, anybody who's anybody is picked very young for the jobs they have to do. I've done shows on this over many years to show you that organizations, especially from the EU, the European Union, for instance, and Common Purpose and things like that, they literally have training exercises out to pick youngsters to create future leaders. Last week or the week before, I did a show which also included something to do with the world government system and everything to do with the massive movement towards total globalization. The leaders are picked long before you'll ever hear of them. Long before, when they're teenagers, some of them as young as 10 and 11 and 12, in fact, before they're teenagers. And they are trained to see the world in a tunnel vision. And it's easy to do when you live a life of luxury, because you will be put into a life of luxury. Doors open for you, and you're given all this deference and money. Money is a great persuader for most people, unfortunately. And getting back to what I was saying, you'll find people in all ages, and every nation can get bought off. Isn't that sad? With money. And I think it's sad. Now, I've met plenty of folk who claim to have psychopathic traits and so on, who see nothing wrong with that. And they've got 1,000 excuses immediately that will come to their lips. Well, if I don't take the money, they'll pick somebody else to do this and so on. Yeah, that's a common thing you'll hear all the time. You'll hear the same things with people who are the thugs for governments and organizations, the heavies, the guys who do the wet jobs. And although most of them aren't so wet, they're done very cleverly through chemicals and high-tech weaponry now, very high-tech weaponry that don't leave many marks at all, if any. Quiet weapons. You know, they're silent weapons for quiet wars, you might say. Now remember what I said at the beginning of this talk on how very little reality you really know, apart from what happens to you daily, on a daily basis, personally. If you stub your toe, you'll know it. But you'll never know what's really happening on the big wild scale, or world scale, the big world scale that affects your lives, because it does. You're living in a pretty well totally controlled system today, and you don't know it. And the beauty for those who control it is that they've trained you not to know it. Remember the behavioral insights teams I mentioned over a few weeks ago? I'll put some links again tonight, but remember that these teams are there to persuade you in so many ways that you know, it's through everything, all ads and little articles you read, embedded stuff everywhere. It's in movies, it's in storylines, to change your opinions about so many things. Getting back to what Aldous Huxley talked about, that perhaps you're being persuaded in ways with these techniques that aren't really good for you at all. To accept things which are possibly detrimental to you. Think about that. Think about Mr. Sutherland too, and his almost pathological hatred of the general publics, that he felt had no say in the matter with all the things that he was helping to implement on top of them to affect millions and millions of people's lives. Think of that. And think of the teams that work with him and Behavioral Insights, etc., and all the organizations that are still working there to persuade you to accept things, and even to persuade you to accept things that you can see are detrimental when you look at the chaos of some of the countries trying to struggle with a massively growing welfare system and folk flooding in all the time. Think about that. And you better understand, there's a much bigger goal to it all. They aren't stupid at the top. And a different system will come out when the whole thing collapses. And that's all planned for as well. That's what's expected to happen. And obviously wanted to happen by those in charge of it. A new system, eh? Brand new system. And think of Mr. Bernays, for instance. He knew this a long time ago as well. An awful long time ago. He also loved to boast about it because he was a massive manipulator. Well, he was one of many, though. Because if we understand the mechanisms and motives of the human mind, is it not possible to control and regiment the masses according to our will without their knowing about it? He worked with government after government, by the way, as well as private corporations. The recent practice of propaganda has proved that it's possible, at least up to a certain point and within certain limits. He also said, in almost every act of our lives, whether in the sphere of politics or business or in some social conduct or our ethical thinking, we are dominated by the relatively small number of persons who understand the mental processes and social patterns of the masses. It is they who pull the wires to control the public mind. And he also said it's all important, of course. Because, see, he wasn't just talking about it. He was helping to implement it in his day. And today it's much, much bigger. It's everywhere you look. He says the conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. So isn't that paradoxical? Because you think you're all free with your own minds and so on in a democratic society. He's telling you the conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Well, I hope you are thinking caps on, and for those who want to know, a lot of folk don't really care. Again, the conditioning has been rather perfect. There's a form of perfect conditioning that works on most folk, most people. Everyone wants to belong to their peer group. You don't want to be shunned because you say something which is politically incorrect, which yesterday was perfectly correct. Because just like your currency being elastic, so is your culture now and your opinions.
This is Aldous Huxley. a man haunted by a vision of hell on earth. A searing social critic, Mr. Huxley, 27 years ago, wrote Brave New World, a novel that predicted that someday the entire world would live under a frightful dictatorship. Today, Mr. Huxley says that his fictional world of horror is probably just around the corner for all of us. We'll find out why in a moment.
The Mike Wallace Interview, presented by the American Broadcasting Company in association with the Fund for the Republic, brings you a special television series discussing the problems of survival and freedom in America.
Good evening, I'm Mike Wallace. Tonight's guest, Aldous Huxley, is a man of letters, as disturbing as he is distinguished. Born in England, now a resident of California, Mr. Huxley has written some of the most electric novels and social criticism of this century. He's just finished a series of essays called Enemies of Freedom, in which he outlines and defines some of the threats to our freedom in the United States. And Mr. Huxley, right off the bat, let me ask you this. As you see it, who and what are the enemies of freedom here in the United States?
Well, I don't think you can say who in the United States. I don't think there are any sinister persons deliberately trying to rob people of their freedom. But I do think, first of all, that there are a number of impersonal forces which are pushing in the direction of less and less freedom. And I also think that there are a number of technological devices which anybody who wishes to use can use to accelerate this process of going away from freedom, of imposing control.
Well, what are these forces and these devices, Mr. Huxley?
I should say that there are two main impersonal forces. The first of them is not exceedingly important in the United States at the present time, though very important in other countries. This is the force which in general terms can be called overpopulation, the mounting pressure of population pressing upon existing resources. This, of course, is an extraordinary thing. Something is happening which has never happened in the world's history before. I mean, let's just take a simple fact that between the time of the birth of Christ and the landing of the Mayflower, the population of the earth doubled. It rose from 250 million to probably 500 million. Today, the population of the earth is rising at such a rate that it will double in half a century.
Well, why should overpopulation work to diminish our freedom?
Well, in a number of ways. I mean, the experts in the field, like Harrison Brown, for example, pointed out that in the underdeveloped countries, actually the standard of living is at present falling, that people have less to eat and less goods per capita than they had 50 years ago. And as the position of these countries, the economic position, becomes more and more precarious, obviously the central government has to take over more and more responsibility for keeping the ship of state on an even keel. And then, of course, you're likely to get social unrest under such conditions, with again an intervention of the central government. So that I think one sees here a pattern which seems to be pushing very strongly towards a totalitarian regime. And unfortunately, as in all these underdeveloped countries, the only highly organized political party is the Communist Party. It looks rather as though they will be the heirs to this unfortunate process, that they will step into the power, position of power.
Well, then, ironically enough, one of the greatest forces against communism in the world, the Catholic Church, according to your thesis, would seem to be pushing us directly into the hands of the communists because they are against birth control.
Well, I think this strange paradox probably is true. It's an extraordinary situation, actually. I mean, one has to look at it, of course, from a biological point of view. The whole essence of biological life on Earth is a question of balance, and what we have done is to practice death control in a most intensive manner without balancing this with birth control at the other end. Consequently, the birth rates remain as high as they were, and death rates have fallen substantially.
All right, then. So much for the time being, anyway, for overpopulation. another force that is diminishing our freedoms?
Well, another force which I think is very strongly operative in this country is the force of what may be called over-organization. As technology becomes more and more complicated, it becomes necessary to have more and more elaborate organizations, more hierarchical organizations. And incidentally, the advance of technology has been accompanied by an advance in the science of organization. It's now possible to make organizations on a larger scale than was ever possible before. And so that you have more and more people living their lives out as subordinates in these hierarchical systems controlled by bureaucracies, either the bureaucracies of big business or the bureaucracies of big government.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the devices that you were talking about, are there specific devices or methods of communication which diminish our freedoms in addition to overpopulation and over-organization?
Well, there are certainly devices which can be used in this way. I mean, let us take, after all, a piece of very recent and very painful history is the propaganda used by Hitler, which was incredibly effective. I mean, what were Hitler's methods? Hitler used terror on the one kind, brute force on the one hand, but he also used a very efficient form of propaganda, which he was using every modern device at that time. He didn't have TV, but he had the radio, which he used to the fullest extent, mm-hmm. and was able to impose his will on an immense mass of people. I mean, the Germans were a highly educated people.
Well, we're aware of all this, but how do you equate Hitler's use of propaganda with the way that propaganda, if you will, is used, let us say, here in the United States? Are you suggesting that there is a parallel?
Needless to say, it's not being used in this way now. But the point is, it seems to me, that there are methods at present available, methods superior in some respects to Hitler's method, which could be used in a bad situation. I mean, what I feel very strongly is that we mustn't be caught by surprise by our own advancing technology. This has happened again and again in history. Technology has advanced, and this changes social conditions, and suddenly people have found themselves in a situation which they didn't foresee and doing all sorts of things they didn't really want to do.
Well, now, what do you mean? Do you mean that we develop our television, but we don't know how to use it correctly? Is that the point that you're making?
Well, at present, the television, I think, is being used quite harmlessly. It's being used, I think, I would feel it's being used too much to distract everybody all the time. But, I mean, imagine, which must be the situation in all communist countries, where the television, where it exists, is always saying the same thing the whole time, is always driving along. It's not creating a wide front of distraction. It's creating a one-pointed drumming in of a single idea all the time. It's obviously an immensely powerful instrument.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about the potential misuse of the instrument.
Exactly. We have, after all technology is in itself morally neutral. These are just powers which can either be used well or ill. It's the same thing with atomic energy. We can either use it to blow ourselves up, or we can use it as a substitute for the coal and the oil which are running out.
You've even written about the use of drugs in this light.
Well, now, this is a very interesting subject. I mean, in this book that you mentioned, this book of mine, Brave New World, I postulated a substance called Soma, which was a very versatile drug. It would make people feel happy in small doses. It would make them see visions in medium doses, and it would send them to sleep in large doses. Well, I don't think such a drug exists now, nor do I think it will ever exist, but we do have drugs which will do some of these things, and I think it's quite on the cards that we may have drugs which will profoundly change our mental states without doing us any harm. I mean, this is the pharmacological revolution which has taken place, that we have now powerful mind-changing drugs which, physiologically speaking, are almost costless. I mean, they are not like opium or like cocaine, which do change the state of mind, but leave terrible results physiologically and morally.
Mr. Huxley, in your new essays, you state that these various enemies of freedom are pushing us toward a real-life, brave new world, and you say that it's awaiting us just around the corner. First of all, can you detail for us what life in this brave new world which you fear so much, what life might be like?
Well, to start with, I think this kind of the dictatorship of the future, I think will be very unlike the dictatorships which we've been familiar with in the immediate past. I mean, take another book prophesying the future, which was a very remarkable book, George Orwell's 1984. Mm-hmm. Well, this book was written at the height of the Stalinist regime and just after the Hitler regime. And there he foresaw a dictatorship using entirely the methods of terror, the methods of physical violence. Now, I think what is going to happen in the future is the dictators will find, as the old saying goes, that you can do everything with bayonets except sit on them. That if you want to preserve your power indefinitely, you have to get the consent of the ruled. That if you want to preserve your power indefinitely, you have to get the consent of the ruled. And this they will do partly by drugs, as I foresaw in Brave New World, partly by these new techniques of propaganda. They will do it by bypassing the sort of rational side of man and appealing to his subconscious and his deeper emotions and his physiology even. They will do it by bypassing the sort of rational side of man and appealing to his subconscious and his deeper emotions and his physiology even, and so making him actually love his slavery. I mean, I think this is the danger, that actually people may be in some ways happy under the new regime, but they will be happy in a situation where they oughtn't to be happy. I mean, I think this is the danger, that actually people may be in some ways happy under the new regime, but they will be happy in a situation where they oughtn't to be happy.
But let me ask you this. You're talking about a world that could take place within the confines of a totalitarian state. Hmm. Let's become more immediate, more urgent about it. We believe, anyway, that we live in democracy here in the United States. Do you believe that this brave new world that you talk about could, let's say in the next quarter century, the next century, could come here to our shores?
I think it could. I mean, that's why I feel it's so extremely important here and now to start thinking about these problems, not to let ourselves be taken by surprise by the new advances in technology. I mean, for example, in regard to the use of the drugs, we know there's enough evidence now for us to be able, on the basis of this evidence and using a certain amount of creative imagination, to foresee the kind of uses which could be made in by people of bad will with these things, and to attempt to forestall this. And in the same way, I think with these other methods of propaganda, we can foresee and we can do a good deal to forestall. I mean, after all, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance.
You write in Enemies of Freedom, you write specifically about the United States. You say this, writing about American political campaigns. You say, all that is needed is money and a candidate who can be coached to look sincere. Political principles and plans for specific action have come to lose most of their importance. The personality of the candidate, the way he is projected by the advertising experts, are the things that really matter.
Well, this is during the last campaign, there was a great deal of this kind of statement by the advertising managers of the campaign parties, this idea that the candidates had to be merchandised as though they were soap or toothpaste, and that you had to depend entirely on the personality. I mean, the personality is important, but there are certainly people with an extremely amiable personality, particularly on TV, who might not necessarily be very good in positions of political trust.
Well, do you feel that men like Eisenhower, Stevenson, Nixon, with knowledge of forethought, were trying to pull the wool over the eyes of the American public?
No, but they were being advised by powerful advertising agencies who were making campaigns of a quite different kind from what had been made before. And I think we shall see probably all kinds of new devices coming into the picture. I mean, for example, this thing which got a good deal of publicity last autumn, a subliminal projection. I mean, as it stands, this thing, I think, is of no menace to us at the moment. But I was talking the other day to one of the people who has done most experimental work in the in psychological laboratory with this, who was saying precisely this, that it is not at the moment a danger, but once you've established a principle that something works, you can be absolutely sure that the technology of it is going to improve steadily. And I mean, his view of the subject was that, well, maybe they will use it to some extent in the 1960 campaign, but they will probably use it a good deal and much more effectively in the 1964 campaign, because this is the kind of rate at which technology advances.
And we'll be persuaded to vote for a candidate that we do not know that we are being persuaded to vote
for. Exactly. I mean, this is the rather alarming feature, that you're being persuaded below the level of choice and reason.
In regard to advertising, which you mentioned just a little ago, in your writing, particularly in Enemies of Freedom, you attack Madison Avenue, which controls most of our television and radio advertising, newspaper advertising, and so forth. Why do you consistently attack the advertising agency?
Well, no, I think that advertisement plays a very necessary role, but the danger, it seems to me, in a democracy is this. I mean, what does a democracy depend on? A democracy depends on the individual voter making an intelligent and rational choice for what he regards as his enlightened self-interest in any given circumstance. But what these people are doing, I mean, what both for their particular purposes, for selling goods, and the dictatorial propagandists are doing, is to try to bypass the rational side of man and to appeal directly to these unconscious forces below the surface, so that you are, in a way, making nonsense of the whole democratic procedure, which is based on conscious choice on rational grounds.
Of course, well, maybe you have just answered this next question, because in your essay you write about television commercials, not just political commercials, but television commercials as such. And how, as you put it, today's children walk around singing beer commercials and toothpaste commercials. And then you link this phenomenon in some way with the dangers of a dictatorship. Now, could you spell out the connection, or how do you feel that you have done so sufficiently?
Well, I mean, here, Kate, this whole question of children, I think, is a terribly important one, because children are quite clearly much more suggestible than the average grown-up. Well, I mean, here, Kate, this whole question of children, I think, is a terribly important one, because children are quite clearly much more suggestible than the average grown-up. And, again, suppose that that for one reason or another, all the propaganda was in the hands of one or very few agencies. And again, suppose that that for one reason or another, all the propaganda was in the hands of one or very few agencies, you would have an extraordinarily powerful force playing on these children, who after all are going to grow up and be adults quite soon. I do think that this is not an immediate threat, but it remains a possible threat. And
you said something to the effect in your essay that the children of Europe used to be called cannon fodder, and here in the United States they are television and radio fodder.
Well, after all, Dave, you can read in the trade journals the most lyrical accounts of how necessary it is to get hold of the children, because then they will be loyal brand buyers later on.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, again, you just translate this into political terms. The dictator says they will be loyal ideology buyers when they're grown up.
We hear so much about brainwashing as used by the communists. Do you see any brainwashing other than that which we've just been talking about that is used here in the United States? Other forms of brainwashing?
Not in the form that has been used in China and in Russia, because this is essentially the application of propaganda methods, the most violent kind, to individuals. It's not a shotgun method like the advertising method. It's a way of getting hold of the person and playing both on his physiology and his psychology, till he really breaks down, and then you can implant a new idea in his head. It's a way of getting hold of the person and playing both on his physiology and his psychology till he really breaks down, and then you can implant a new idea in his head. I mean, the descriptions of the methods are really blood-curdling when you read them, and not only the methods applied to political prisoners, but the methods applied, for example, to the training of the young communist administrators and missionaries. They receive an incredibly tough kind of training, which causes about 25% of them to break down or commit suicide, but produces 75% of completely one-pointed fanatics.
The question, of course, that keeps coming back to my mind is this. Obviously, politics in themselves are not evil. Television is not in itself evil. Atomic energy is not evil. And yet you seem to fear that it will be used in an evil way. Why is it that the right people will not, in your estimation, use them? Why is it that the wrong people will use these various devices and for the wrong motives?
Well, I think one of the reasons is that these are all instruments for obtaining power, and obviously the passion for power is one of the most moving passions that exist in man, and these are all instruments for obtaining power, and obviously the passion for power is one of the most moving passions that exist in man, and after all, this is all democracies are based on the proposition that power is very dangerous, and that it's extremely important not to let any one man or any one small group have too much power for too long a time. After all, what are the British and American constitutions except devices for limiting power? And all these new devices are extremely efficient instruments for the imposition of power by small groups over larger masses. And all these new devices are extremely efficient instruments for the imposition of power by small groups over larger masses.
Well, you ask this question yourself in Enemies of Freedom. I'll put your own question back to you. You ask this: in an age of accelerating overpopulation, of accelerating overorganization, and ever more efficient means of mass communication, how can we preserve the integrity and reassert the value of the human individual? You put the question. Now here's your chance to answer it, Mr. Huxley.
Well, this is obviously, first of all, it's a question of education. I think it's terribly important to insist on individual values. I mean, what is there is a tendency, as you probably read a book by White, The Organization Man, a very interesting, valuable book, I think, where he speaks about the new type of group morality, group ethic, which speaks about the group as though the group were somehow more important than the individual. But this seems, as far as I'm concerned, to be in contradiction with what we know about the genetical makeup of human beings, that every human being is unique, And it is, of course, on this genetical basis that the whole idea of the value of freedom is based. And I think it's extremely important for us to stress this in all our educational life. And I would say it's also very important to teach people to be on their guard against the sort of verbal booby traps into which they're always being led, to analyze the kind of things that are said to them. And I would say it's also very important to teach people to be on their guard against the sort of verbal booby traps into which they're always being led, to analyze the kind of things that are said to them. Well, I think there is this whole educational side, and I think there are many more things that one could do to strengthen people and to make them more aware of what was being done.
You're a prophet of decentralization.
Well, yes, if this is feasible. It's one of the tragedies, it seems to me. I mean, many people have been talking about the importance of decentralization in order to give back to the voter a sense of direct power. I mean, the voter in an enormous electorate feels quite impotent, and his vote seems to count for nothing. This is not true where the electorate is small and where he is dealing with a group which he can manage and understand. And if one can, as Jefferson, after all, suggested break up the units into smaller and smaller units and so get a real self-governing democracy.
Well, that was all very well in Jefferson's day, but how can we revamp our economic system and decentralize and at the same time meet militarily and economically the tough challenge of a country like Soviet Russia?
Well, I think the answer to that is that there are, it seems to me that the production, industrial production, is of two kinds. I mean, there are some kinds of industrial production which obviously need the most tremendously high centralization, like the making of automobiles, for example. But there are many other kinds where you could decentralize quite easily and probably quite economically, and that you would then have this kind of decentralized life. After all, you begin to see it now if you travel through the south, this decentralized textile industry which is springing up there.
Mr. Huxley, let me ask you this quite seriously. Is freedom necessary? Quite seriously. Is freedom necessary?
As far as I'm concerned, it is, yes.
Why? Is it necessary for a productive society?
Yes, I should say it is. I mean, a genuinely productive society. I mean, I think you could produce plenty of goods without much freedom. But I think the whole sort of creative life of man is ultimately impossible without a considerable measure of individual freedom. That initiative, creation, all these things which we value, and I think value properly, are impossible without a large measure of freedom.
Well, Mr. Huxley, take a look again at the country which is in the stance of our opponent anyway it would seem to be there, Soviet Russia. It is strong and getting stronger economically, militarily. At the same time, it's developing its art forms pretty well. It seems not unnecessarily to squelch the creative urge among its people, and yet it is not a free society.
It's not a free society, but here is something very interesting, that those members of the society, like the scientists who are doing the creative work, are given far more freedom than anybody else. I mean, it's a privileged aristocratic society. Those members of the society, like the scientists who are doing the creative work, are given far more freedom than anybody else. I mean, it's a privileged aristocratic society in which, provided that they don't poke their noses into political affairs, these people are given a great deal of prestige, a considerable amount of freedom, and a lot of money. I mean, this is a very interesting fact about the new Soviet regime, and I think what we're going to see is a people on the whole with very little freedom, but with an oligarchy on top enjoying a considerable measure of freedom and a very high standard of living. A people on the whole with very little freedom, but with an oligarchy on top enjoying a considerable measure of freedom and a very high standard of living.
And the people down below, the epsilons down below,
enjoying very little.
And you think that that kind of situation can long endure?
I think it can certainly endure much longer than a situation in which everybody is kept down. Because, I mean, they can certainly get their technological and scientific results on such a basis.
Well, the next time that I talk to you then, perhaps we should investigate further the possibility of the establishment of that kind of a society, where the drones work for the queen bees up above. Where the drones work for the queen bees up above.
Well, but yes, but I must say I still believe in democracy. If we can make the best of the creative activities of the people on top plus those of the people on the bottom, so much the better.
Mr. Huxley, I surely thank you for spending this half hour with us, and I wish you Godspeed, sir.
Thank you.
Aldous Huxley finds himself these days in a peculiar and disturbing position. A quarter of a century after prophesying an authoritarian state in which people were reduced to ciphers. He can point at Soviet Russia and say, I told you so. The crucial question, as he sees it now, is whether the so-called free world is shortly going to give Mr. Huxley the further dubious satisfaction of saying the same thing about us. Stay tuned for a preview of next week's interview. Till then, Mike Wallace, good night.
From myself, Alan Watt, this good night to me, your God or your gods go with you.